right, welcome. I'm James Cooper. I'm a professor at Anton Scalia Law School at George Mason University and the director of the program on economics and privacy there. It's my great pleasure to be here to moderate a fantastic panel we have to look at big tech, antitrust, and privacy as part of the Law and Economics Center's Congressional Civil Justice Caucus Academy. So if I didn't say enough jargon, I got all that out of the way. Events like Cambridge Analytica scandals, Russian meddling in U.S. elections, and the growing role of platforms as curators of information have brought the large role that these platforms play in our daily lives into sharp relief. So perhaps it's not surprising that these platforms have increasingly become the focal point of regulatory and legislative attention. One theme that is often raised, is that our current antitrust laws are not up to the task of addressing anti-competitive behavior in this arena. That is, some conduct may slip through the cracks. Further, outside of addressing core antitrust issues, some have also suggested that antitrust could be used as a tool to police other perceived problems blamed on platforms. For example, some have argued that these platforms are biased against conservative voices or eroding consumer privacy, and that monopoly is at the root of this problem and antitrust could be the cure. Things are happening. FTC and DOJ have announced that they're investigating some of these major tech platforms for possible antitrust violations, and not to be outdone, the state attorneys generals have come together to conduct their own wide-ranging investigations into the same companies. As a solution to some of these problems, several commentators, academics have suggested limiting the ability of large tech firms to merge. There's legislation, or at least one bill, that would lower the legal threshold for blocking a merger. And some presidential candidates are calling for the outright breakup of large tech firms. Indeed, for the first time in my memory, antitrust is front and center in a presidential election. Indeed, antitrust is sexy. For the first time, I think.
1914.
Okay. So first time in over a century, antitrust has been sexy. So while many have expressed concerns over these tech platforms and a push for increased regulatory scrutiny, it's important to proceed with caution and a full understanding of the problems that need to be tackled. At the end of the day, addressing these concerns raised by big tech in a way that benefits consumers requires complex and agile balancing of a variety of interests. And today we're lucky to have a fantastic panel to delve into some of these issues. To my immediate right, there is Bruce Hoffman. He's currently, at least until the winter solstice, the director of the Bureau of Competition at the Federal Trade Commission. And before that, he was a partner at Sherman & Sterling, and he had been at the FTC when I first met him back in the early 2000s as the deputy director for the Bureau of Competition. To Bruce's right is Charlotte Slayman. She's a senior policy counsel at Public Knowledge, and before that, she's also was in the Anti-Competitive Practices Division at the Federal Trade Commission until 2018. And then finally, at the end of the panel is John Yoon. John is a colleague of mine at Anton Scalia Law School. We went to grad school together, a little fun fact there. And he's the director of the economic education at the Global Antitrust Institute. And like everybody else in the panel, has also been at the FTC. He was a staff economist and an advisor to Commissioner Josh Wright, leaving the commission 2017. All right, so we have a, like I said, we have a fantastic panel. We're gonna hopefully make this more discussional, and I'd like to leave some time for questions from you at the end. So, what I want to start to kick this off at kind of the big level, a big picture question to everyone on the panel, and I'll let everyone weigh in first before we delve down into some more nuance, is, does antitrust need to be updated to deal with these issues, or is the current toolkit sufficient? I mean, that is, some have argued that antitrust currently has a blind spot in the tech area where things are, the prices are zero, So I will let Bruce start this off and just go down the panel. So is antitrust up to the task?
Thanks, James. Is this thing on? Yeah. Well, let me start with the disclaimer I have to give for two more weeks, which is at this particular session, I speak only for myself and not necessarily for the commission or any commissioner or the Bureau of Competition. And depending on what I say, I may not actually be speaking for myself. So with that disclaimer said, here's what I'd say, James. I think, first of all, the notion that antitrust needs to be changed in some way or that it has a blind spot for tech platforms is, I think, demonstrably wrong. And I say that because I've been doing this for a while, and this exact same issue has arisen with regularity about every 5 to 10 years. Whenever there's a change in the economy, some kind of new business arises, a new business model, a new industry, invariably there's this cry out that antitrust isn't up to it and something needs to be changed about antitrust to deal with it, and invariably that proves to be incorrect. As I think best illustrated in the dot-com era and the Microsoft case and the Intel case that came out of that era, where back then, and you can actually go and read, there are speeches that were given about whether or not antitrust could handle technology, could handle the internet and whatnot, and then you had these big cases where antitrust, I think, asserted itself with fairly demonstrable effect. Why do I say antitrust doesn't need to be changed beyond that just empirical piece? Because antitrust actually is a very flexible tool. If you actually look at the antitrust laws, they're incredibly short. They don't say very much. They just say contracts, combinations, or conspiracies and restraint of trade are illegal, and it's a violation of law to monopolize, attempt to monopolize, or conspire to monopolize, and that's it. Leaving aside the merger law, which also is pretty succinct. So they're very short, and what you fill those laws with in terms of enforcement is the current best knowledge of economics, of legal analysis, of our understanding of industries. So antitrust itself, as the statutes are written, is simply a policy goal, in essence, which is then given life by the best current state of knowledge. And that is why, because antitrust isn't a laundry list of prohibited practices or that sort of thing, which would be out of date as soon as it was written, because it is succinct, the laws are succinct, and because the way those laws are operationalized is through applying current knowledge, antitrust has been able for over 100 years to adapt to changes in the economy, changes in business, and I don't see any reason to think that wouldn't continue to be true.
Thanks, Bruce. Charlotte, what do you think? Is antitrust up to it?
Thanks. So antitrust can do a lot, and I don't disagree with Bruce's points, but there are also plenty of pro-competition laws that govern areas of our economy that are not antitrust, and I think big tech is going to be one of those areas. What we need here are new laws and rules focused on promoting competition in this particular sector because of some special economic characteristics of digital platforms specifically. So I would really commend you to read the Stiegler Digital Competition, Digital Platforms and Market Power Report out of the University of Chicago. There's the UK Digital Competition Report and the Vestager Digital Competition Report, but I think the Stiegler Report is sort of the US version. And several smart antitrust economists and lawyers came together and looked at digital platforms and determined these are some important economic characteristics that are creating a very anti-competitive situation here. And it's not necessarily violations of the antitrust laws, but there is an economic situation that is making it very difficult for any new competitors to start up. So some of the limitations of antitrust law that we don't necessarily need to change, but just make it difficult for that to be effective in situations like this, are that the remedies need to be narrowly tailored to the violation. That's a good thing in antitrust law. That makes perfect sense. But if the violation of antitrust law is not actually the source of the problem, antitrust law is not going to be able to fix the broader problem. So the broader problem, as we've identified in the Stiegler report, is there are these three economic characteristics of digital platforms that make it very difficult for new competitors to start up. One is network effects. Network effects can sound very complicated, but I think it's actually very simple. It's just that I want to be where the people are, right? Like the Little Mermaid. If a company has a lot of users already, that's very useful to new users. They want to be where those users are. That makes it really hard for a new competitor to start up. and have success, because people might want to leave. People might want to leave Facebook when they hear about Cambridge Analytica. But if their friends don't leave with them, it's not very useful to go to a competitor. So network effects is a really powerful incumbency advantage that digital platforms benefit from. The next is economies of scope and scale. And I think this really has to do with the value of data in digital platforms. So an example I think of is Google has all of these great services. It has Gmail, it has a map, it has traffic data from Waze, so it can tell me, you know, which way I should go when I'm going somewhere to avoid traffic. And it has my calendar. So Google can use those four pieces of data that it has about me to tell me when I need to leave for the airport. But a new competitor that only has a Maps app can't do that. It doesn't know that I have a flight. It doesn't know where I'm starting out from. It doesn't have traffic data. So having that economy of scope, having so many different services and different sources of data, allows them to provide a great service, but it's a real barrier to entry for a new company that wants to come in. The last is behavioral ticks of consumers like us. We are not always completely rational. Sometimes it's rational not to go through all the effort of checking every possible competitor, right? If you're buying oven mitts, you might not look at six different pairs of oven mitts to make sure you're getting the very best oven mitts. I don't check to see if the Bing algorithm has gotten more effective. I just stick with Google. And that kind of thing can be exploited and manipulated by companies that have a lot of data about us. Or even if they don't do that, it just has a natural effect where people tend to single home, which is just use one competitor. So these are the types of problems that are not an antitrust violation, but make a big difference. And so I think we need new laws and rules to regulate big tech.
All right. Thanks, Charlotte. Let me turn to John for the... answer the big picture question about, does antitrust need, does it need to change, or is it up to the task? And then while you're answering, you can respond to anything you Charlotte put a lot on the table that you may or may not agree with, and I know Bruce wants to discuss some of that too, so we'll just kind of swing back around on that, and maybe I'll put network effects on your plate, because I know you've testified and written a lot about network effects too.
Thank you, James, and thank you for being here today. Let me share with you a quote. It is difficult to imagine that in an open society such as this one, with multiple information sources, a single company could seize sufficient control of information transmission so as to constitute a threat to the underpinnings of a free society. But such a scenario is realistic and perhaps probable outcome. Obviously, we're talking about Google and Facebook, but actually we're not. That was in 1995. This is going back to the point that Bruce made. This was mentioned about Microsoft when they were buying Intuit, which was ultimately blocked. And Intuit owned Quicken at the time, and there was a concern that Microsoft money was going to be suppressed and they weren't going to launch the product. Well, they were blocked from buying it. Microsoft money, obviously something we all use. I point to this, look, agencies get things wrong. I'm not trying to make fun of agencies. I was there a long time to get a lot of things right. But the point is that making predictions about technology markets are incredibly difficult. And so this idea that big is bad is something that is very common. I mean, if you look back to the origins of the antitrust laws, you go back to Standard Oil, and then you go to AT&T, AMP, in fact. You could go to IBM and Microsoft. All these have been under heavy scrutiny, and perhaps rightly so, and there were antitrust cases against them, but the case law was able to handle those big companies because the economics, as Bruce mentioned, evolves, and we're able to use those tools in a sort of a common law regime, even though it was a statutory regime, to really incorporate that into our assessment. And I don't think that's any different today. So is there anything different about Google and Facebook? Charlotte mentioned some characteristics, and those are important characteristics that we have to consider, including network effects, their platforms, they're bringing different groups together, big data, there's a lot of privacy issues involved, economies of scale and scope. All those are relevant considerations, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But what I would say is that what we need to do is dig deep into what these effects are doing. Are they good for consumers, or are they actually harmful to consumers? And if so, are they violating antitrust laws? Just because you have network effects and you're creating products and a lot of value, and that makes it more difficult for consumer, for a rival to come and compete against you, that isn't necessarily an antitrust violation. Now, if we want to go further and say, well, we should regulate it in a different way, we can debate that, and I think in terms of purity, I think that's a better approach. I wouldn't recommend it, but at least I can understand the logic. But to say that antitrust system itself is broken, I think is a problem. I would disagree with that, and I'm not saying people are here are saying that, but others are saying that it's broken and can't handle these firms. I think it can handle them. The question is do we want to move outside of antitrust and to regulate them in a different way? That's a totally separate question. And so just to conclude my thoughts here, the reason why I think I have trouble with that we need a new paradigm is that what exactly is the theory of harm? What exactly are these firms doing that is so harmful to welfare and efficiency? And I think absent a really clear understanding of that, we're not going to have a very good case. And not surprisingly, the agencies haven't brought a case. They've looked at these very intensely and deeply. I was there when they looked at Google, and those cases were clear, and I think rightly so. And the reason is because while we're hearing about privacy violations and about economies of scale and scope, it doesn't come down to an actual theory where consumers are really being harmed. Now, you don't have entry, you don't have various things of that nature. But again, not having entry is not an anti-competitive violation in and of itself. So what exactly are they doing and what are they violating? And I think that's a something we should debate, but I think that's where I'll leave it off.
All right. Thanks, John. Bruce, do you want to jump in and respond to some things?
Yeah, I actually want to step back a little bit because I think both Charlie and John said a really important thing, but I think there's a level that we need to go back from that to understand what we're actually talking about here. So we have been talking a little bit about, is something an antitrust violation or is it not? As if that's some sort of independent value in and of itself. I think it's important to understand what we mean by saying is something an antitrust violation, because Charlotte's point was, well, it might not be an antitrust violation, but maybe we should do something about it anyway. And that could certainly be true, but I think it's important to start by saying, well, what is an antitrust violation? And the basic proposition that the antitrust laws enforce is that we don't want companies to engage in conduct that harms competition or harms consumers. In other words, we don't mind if companies succeed, right? It's good for companies to succeed. It's good for companies to grow. It's good for companies to do well. We just don't want them doing that by colluding with their rivals, price fixing and that sort of thing, or by engaging in anti-competitive conduct, like, for example, as has actually happened in China, doing things like slipping poison into rival food companies' products so that consumers are killed when they eat them. You know, we don't want that kind of conduct going on. But the antitrust laws themselves do not prohibit success, right? They don't prohibit companies from doing a good job. And so when you say, well, it's not an antitrust violation, but we should still do something about it, I think you need to step back and say, well, wait a minute. Is it not an antitrust violation because the company has simply succeeded because it's better at doing things than anyone else? And if that's the case, I think you want to think very carefully about whether you want to do something about that. Do we really want an economy where the government punishes companies who are actually just doing a better job than their rivals? I would suggest the answer to that question is no. Now, there are different issues, right? You can imagine people are concerned about the content of speech on Facebook or things like that. Those are potentially legitimate concerns. I will tell you, as an antitrust regulator, I think the absolute last worst thing in the world you want is a bunch of antitrust regulators figuring out what speech ought to be in the public domain. I don't want that job. I don't think I should be trusted with that job, and I don't think anybody else in my position should be trusted with the job of figuring out what speech should be allowed in the public domain. But maybe there's some other vehicle, as with the FCC or places like that, where you can regulate specific kinds of things to address them. On a couple more specific points, I think the Stigler report is very worth reading, but I think there's an important caveat I would give to that. The Stigler report, if you actually go look at it, is full of what I would describe as possibility theorems, right? And what I mean by that is the authors of that report, whom I know well and respect, imagined a bunch of possibilities. They say, well, we observe this state of the market, and it's possible that the following anti-competitive things are going on or are explanations for it. But it's also possible that they're not. One of the big things about the Stigler report, and this is also true in the UK report and in Bessinger's report, is that they don't distinguish between the possibility that the outcome that's being observed results from anti-competitive behavior or simply from these particular firms just being better competitors than their rivals. Either of those things is possible. And so when you look at those reports, you have to understand that. On a couple of these other points, and just very quickly, I agree with Charlotte completely about the distinguishing characteristics, which, by the way, always makes me think of the Bugs Bunny snowman episode, because at one point it says, what's the distinguishing characteristic of the abominable snowman? I had to match the Little Mermaid reference. But the thing about network effects is, once again, it's important to understand that these are very fact-specific things. Network effects exist, right? They're real. They exist in Facebook. They exist in Google to some extent. But it's also important to remember that network effects, though they can be a barrier to entry, also facilitate it, right? Because if you have strong network effects and you actually get a toehold, those same network effects that were making it hard for you to start can actually drastically accelerate your ramp up. So they work both ways, particularly where there's multi-homing. It's not an open and shut thing. Similarly, economies of scope and scale or data, those are things that create the same kind of circumstance. And on the data side, I would say, it's not clear at this point if data is actually that helpful. For example, I don't know how many people here are familiar with Google Flu. Google had a data-driven program to identify instances of flu. It was the state-of-the-art with big data. It was a spectacular failure because it had the wrong correlations in it. And so the AI system they were using to predict flu got worse and worse. At first, it started matching actual flu incidents. Then it got worse and worse and worse and worse. There are congestion and other effects that occur with data that don't make it unambiguously positive. As far as consumer irrationality, I'm not really sure what to say about that in terms of antitrust. It's difficult to write laws that say we recognize that people are irrational and we're going to fix them. I'm not sure. By assumption, if people are irrational, then therefore I'm irrational too. And so it's not obvious to me that I'm in a better position to protect other people from their irrationality than I am protect me from my own irrationality. So it's a little bit of a difficult thing to operationalize. But anyway, I do think those are true things about these businesses that are worth taking into account. I just don't think it's an unambiguous output from them.
Oh, good. Charlotte, I imagine you have something
Thank
to say
you.
About this.
So just to address the last point real quick before I forget, it's not about protecting consumers from being irrational, right? It's about creating a promoting a competitive environment where competitors can succeed despite the fact that consumers are not constantly seeking out new alternatives, even though they might be better. So in terms of laying out the harms, I do think that we have had a lot of conversations about this, but the House Judiciary Committee is doing an in-depth investigation into competition and big tech right now, and I think that's going to be really valuable in getting a clear explanation of the harms, which I think will be really helpful towards writing legislation that will be effective. So that is happening. You should all participate and pay attention to it, because I think it's really important and it's a great opportunity that you guys have here in Congress. Okay. So certainly we do not want to be punishing companies for their success. I know this is a common part of antitrust theory. These companies were successful, and that is great. But now we don't know if they are continuing to actually provide the best product, because consumers don't have the opportunity to choose an alternative. There isn't very much entry, as Professor Yoon mentioned, and so there isn't a lot of competition going on, so it's hard for us to know whether these products really are still the best, or still are, you know, the most efficient and operating innovatively and effectively, because there isn't competition and there isn't much of an opportunity to choose an alternative. So that's what we're trying to promote with these new pro-competition policies. And it may turn out that once there is competition, that Facebook will still win, Google will still win, and that's fine, but there needs to be competition. And that will hopefully encourage them to continue to improve their products in the way that they once did. Certainly there are other issues that are not well addressed through antitrust, and there are other issues that are not well addressed through competition. I think privacy is one of those issues that is not going to be well addressed through competition. We really need privacy legislation to protect users' privacy. I think privacy is something that's really hard for people to make their own assessments on. So it's very easy to have competition along the criteria of price. It's very easy for me to see what the different prices are and compare them. And even with a lot of quality measures, consumers can make quality decisions. Privacy is really hard. You could read the privacy policy, but companies might violate the privacy policy. And the privacy policy, even contracts professors could have trouble understanding those privacy policies. Also, you don't know how the data might be used in the future. It's not clear to me as a consumer when you're collecting, for example, my shopping data, all of the many different uses that that shopping data might have. They're, you know, contributing to algorithms that can make predictions about my health status based on my shopping information. And that changes over time. So even if you are a very well-informed consumer now, you don't know how they might be using your data in the future. I think it's incredibly complex and difficult for consumers to assess. So competition, I think, will not be sufficient to solve the privacy problem. We need privacy legislation. I'll stop there since I'm talking a lot.
Oh, okay. well, anyway, let me... it's not really switch gears. It's really the... I want to move to John and ask maybe more specific question. And we've been talking a lot about prices and being able, you know, Charlotte was saying that it's really easy to look at prices and as a metric. You know, antitrust is predicated, the consumer welfare standard is how we judge whether a practice in antitrust is pro or anti-competitive and ultimately violates antitrust laws or not. To what extent, when we live in a world where everything's free, right? All of these platforms, the price is zero. Does the consumer welfare standard, as it's been applied, first of all, maybe you can explain what it is, because sometimes it's caricatured a little bit to those who don't practice antitrust law. You know, maybe talk about it a little bit, and then is it up to the task in these zero price markets?
Okay, so let me start by saying that economics can broadly be divided into normative and positive statements. And positive statements are statements of what is. So if you say the demand of a product goes up, you would then say price or quantity goes up. That might not actually turn out to be true, but it's still a positive statement of what you expect to happen. Similar with minimum wage, that it will cause this type of benefit or this type of cost, right? Those are positive statements. Normative statements are statements of what ought to be. It's an assessment of how things should be. So, example, we should have minimum wage laws because X, Y, and Z, or we should increase our regulation of these tech firms because of X, Y, and Z, right? So that's a statement of opinion, if you will. And so what's interesting is that how do we assess the performance of a market? Well, that ultimately actually comes down to a normative assessment. We have to make a judgment of what we think a successful market is. And so what the measure economists use is this measure of efficiency. And efficiency is based on looking at the performance or the welfare of the two participants in a market. There's always a buyer and a seller. So we look at the buyer side, and we call that consumer welfare or consumer surplus. And we look at the seller side, and we call that producer surplus or producer welfare. And they both matter in terms of a market. And so combined, we call those gains from trade. And so if we're trying to maximize the gains from trade, we call that efficiency. So even if we think of efficiency as going up and down, that's a positive statement. The concept itself is a normative concept. We're using this as our basis for the performance of market rather than market share or there's a lot of firms or there's a lot of choices. We don't make that assessment. We'd rather focus on the welfare itself. So why this lead up? Well, consumer welfare is a very intuitive concept and it's very useful. If you go, let's say that you're looking for a new wool coat and you're willing to pay $500 if it was made in Seattle. And so where do you go if you want a coat made in Seattle? You'd probably go to Filson. And you look online and the Mackinac Cruiser is pretty much $500. It's like $380. Well, we would predict that you would make that choice in that you have a higher willingness to pay than the price that it's being offered at. Your surplus, the differential, is the difference between what you're willing to pay, the $500, and the price that you actually end up paying. So it gives us a good measure of your participation in the market and the value of that market existing for you as a consumer. So James mentioned the zero price. Many have raised the specter that, well, consumer welfare can't handle zero price. But it can because it's not price per se. It doesn't have to have a positive price. It's a concept that matters. So let's say that you go on Facebook, and Facebook puts in a new policy where there's a 30-second ad before you can start using it. That's going to cause most people disutility, most normal people disutility. You're like, 30 seconds? I gotta I don't know what people do on Facebook. I got to do my feed.
Something
needs to happen, and it has to happen now.
Yeah.
I'm grumpy. I'm unhappy. So you have a disutility, right? That's the price, the increase in price, if you will, that Facebook has put on you. So it's really more of an opportunity cost. What is the opportunity cost of you, whether paying a product, the money that now leaves your wallet, that now pays for a code, or the time that you lose by waiting on the ad? That's still the price that you're paying, and you still get a benefit that you receive from going on that platform. So consumer welfare is robust to zero price, and so I think we're too focused on the zero price sort of critique of consumer surplus. When we look at dig down, the concept is still valid for it.
Oh, thanks. So
go ahead.
Did you have something to add, Bruce? You're kind of looking at me.
Well,
so I didn't.
Yeah, I'll just
stop looking at me.
I'll just say this about consumer welfare. I think that people don't actually understand what we mean when we say consumer welfare, and this was kind of John's point. It's not. The antitrust agencies, antitrust courts, and enforcers have not ever said that consumer welfare doesn't include producers or anything like that. It's really just a shorthand for saying that when we're figuring out if we're going to condemn something as illegal under the antitrust laws, do we count the benefits to the people that engaged in the conduct? And the answer to that usually is no. So, for example, when people fix prices, we don't say, well, we're going to net out the benefit to them of fixing the prices against the harm to everybody who paid the higher price. We say, that benefit to you for fixing the price doesn't count. Okay, we're only going to look at the harm, and we're going to punish you for that. So it's not, and in mergers, for example, we've long looked at what we call monopsony cases, which are mergers that affect sellers as well as buyers. We do that under what we call the consumer welfare standard. It may just be sloppy language on our part, but it's never just been about consumers. And as John pointed out, it's never just been about price. Now, price is easier to measure because it's a number. And so when you're writing an equation, you could stick a number in there. But you could do the same thing, and we actually do the same thing for quality and innovation and lots of other things like that. I think Charlotte's point about privacy, which we may come back to, is a really important point. But I would say that it's not obvious to me, and I just don't know the answer to this, but it's not obvious to me that privacy is inherently less tractable than other quality measures, that there's something about it that's different. I agree that it's hard to know. Like, I think I was listening to NPR, I guess, last year, and somebody counted how long it would take to read all the privacy policies of the various online services that you interact with, and they estimated it would take the average person 5 weeks out of every year of just sitting there reading the privacy policy. So clearly that's never going to happen. But that's true for many things. Nobody reads fine print. Right, we assume competition will solve these problems because if you actually offer more privacy, like Apple does, for example, people who value more privacy will go to that, and so the market will solve these problems. It is possible that privacy hasn't done that well, not because it's harder to measure, but because people don't care, or that they get a lot from giving up privacy. Charlotte, as you pointed out, for example, mapping software with very strong privacy constraints may save me a lot of privacy, may keep my data very secret, but it may be very hard for me to use if the map doesn't know where I am. So people, when you give up privacy, you give up data, you actually get an immediate benefit from doing that. So it may be that rather than losses of privacy being unambiguously bad and something that is sort of a one-directional quality change, that's actually much more complicated. And the reason that we haven't seen competition unambiguously moving towards more privacy is because actually there's a real value in giving up some privacy. And so the market's got to sort that out and figure out where it ends up. I just don't know the answer to that, but I think that's a problem that I would be hesitant to decide in advance as a matter of regulation without letting things sort themselves out.